This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Buenos Doritos, Junkions, and welcome to another high-shooting, high-falutin' episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Really, it's not an extreme episode?
It's an extreme episode, but it's not like Mountain Dew extreme. It's
not
more
like 1990s extreme?
No,
Around in a truck and doing the craziest shit possible?
It's more like the extreme of when you demand the head of Alfredo Garcia extreme is kind of what we're dealing with here. But this is, of course, Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is one bad hombre, C. Robert Cargo.
Hi.
And does that have anything to do with omelets? I keep hearing the word hombre, and all I want is an omelet every time I hear it.
I kind of want an hombre omelet.
Is that a thing? We should make that a thing if it's not already a thing.
We really should make an hombre omelet.
Considering the star of this movie, I feel like an hombre omelet is just a regular omelet, and then you pour like a bunch of scotch on top of it just
the
while it's cooking.
The star of this movie? This isn't a movie with like 12 fucking stars to it?
You're stepping on the toes of our own show before we even get started. Hey.
Fuck these toes.
Fuck those toes. We will twinkle back onto those toes in just a moment, but I want to remind you guys that we're on all of the social medias. We're on the Twitters, at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on the Book of Faces, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And you can rate and review us on iTunes. Please keep doing that. Oh my God, you guys, we were very briefly on that list of top 200 film casts on iTunes, and it made me so happy. And then we got more reviews and then disappeared from the list. I still don't know how that fucking works. It drives me up the wall. I feel like Jack Nicholson's in that big room in the Overlook just like typing away and not really understanding what's going on and slowly going insane. But yeah, those 5-star reviews and the ratings you leave us, we really, really do appreciate that. We also appreciate it when you decide that you really like the show and you want to become a patron. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We are so thankful, so grateful to you guys for your support. It's what helps keep the lights on here, helps keep us in our best bolo ties and our snakeskin boots, and just looking sharp at all times, looking as sharp as Powers Booth as often as we possibly can. So if you want to continue to not see that happen, because this is a radio show, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
Radio? What is this? Well, 1993?
I mean, what else do you call it? It's not video. It's basically radio. Podcast is the new radio. Not so hot take. So I'm really excited because the summer of 87, One Junkie Summer, is rolling along, and we pulled an audible on this particular episode because of the passing of the amazing Powers Booth. And it dawned on me that there was a Powers Booth movie, a Walter Hill movie from 1987.
That we were going to cover this summer anyway.
That we had talked about covering this summer, but that I hadn't seen and was super excited to discover.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it's not often that you get to discover a new film by, you know, not necessarily a new film, but a film you haven't seen by a director whose name alone will sell you on the movie. And True. Then as you start digging into the cast, you get more and more excited.
Very much so.
It's like, hey, there's a Walter Hill movie you haven't seen. Oh, shit. Is it worth seeing? Well, it's got Nick Nolte. Oh, shit. And Powers Booth. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And that's just the beginning.
That's the tip of the iceberg. And you're right. If I haven't seen it, it is new to me. And if there's one director who will sell me on name alone, it's one of my favorite directors of all time, Mr. Walter Hill. So, yes, we were very excited to check out Extreme Prejudice.
Somewhere in America, a secret war is being waged.
This is a case of national security.
Go. A war of deception.
It's a daylight hit.
I come over to talk about the bomb that went off yesterday. I got 2 people dead.
Fought by a phantom army.
Sergeant Buck Atwater killed Laos in 74. How can they be officially dead and 2 of them locked up in there?
It's classified.
Now, he's the only one that stands in their way.
Termination with extreme prejudice.
Anyone could be the enemy.
Tell the FBI to kiss my...
want to tell me about it?
I can't talk about it. I gotta do something about it.
Nothing is what it seems.
What the hell's the military robbing banks in Texas for?
And unless he can stop them,
it's poison.
Everything he stands for is at stake. Nick Nolte. Extreme Prejudice.
Which has not been readily available, which is why a lot of people haven't seen it. And when Powers Booth sadly passed, several people in our feed started talking about Extreme Prejudice. And it was one of those things where we were like, well, we were already going to cover that later this summer. Let's bump this ahead.
Yeah.
And so it became mandatory viewing. And of course, hell yes. Is it every bit as awesome as everybody says it is?
Before we dig into the plot, let's just look at the ingredients on the side of this fucking box. We've already mentioned Nick Nolte and Powers Booth and the fact that it's directed by Walter Hill. What we didn't mention is that the original story was written by, just some guy named John Milius. I got so erect.
I know.
Watching the credits for this movie.
Up, I was like, oh, Brian's going to lose his shit.
I was like, are you fucking kidding me? So not only is it a Walter Hill movie I've never seen, not only is it a Powers Booth performance that I'm ignorant of, but it's a John Milius story that I am just now discovering. Bring it the fuck on. And it didn't stop there. Michael Ironside's name shows up in the credits. My head almost exploded. Maria Conchita Alonso, because it is in fact a late 80s movie, so fuck yeah, bring that on.
Yeah.
Rip Torn.
Which, at this point, while I'm watching this movie, my wife just turns to me and she goes, if I didn't know better, I would think all of these names were made up.
Michael Ironside, Powers Booth.
Rip Torn, Maria Conchita Alonso. It's, and then finally, you know, we start getting the names where she's like, okay, well, that's not a made up name.
Names like Clancy Brown.
Fuck yes, like, Clancy Brown. Once I realized Clancy Brown was in this, I was like, done, sold.
There's no Kurgan back now because Clancy Brown's in the movie along with William Forsythe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, it keeps going. Oh,
yeah, then you've got Matt Mulhern, you've got Larry B. Scott as part of this particular crew as well. Then you have like small bit parts in this movie, like one of the early appearances of Tiny Lister Jr.
Tiny fucking Lister, the man so nice they erroneously named him twice. He is in fact not tiny at all, and in this movie plays a henchman who used to be an NFL player. And one of my favorite lines of dialogue in this movie is he says to Nick Nolte, I hurt my knee. And Nick Nolte said, it looks like you hurt your face.
Yeah.
Because Tiny Lister's not an attractive guy, but he is enormous. So it makes sense that he would be in this movie.
You've got Mickey Jones as well.
My favorite of the monkeys.
Well, wah, wah.
Wait, is that not the...
No.
Okay, all right.
No, just a guy that he's one of those character actors that every time you see it, it's like, oh, it's that guy.
Is that... Okay, not knowing the name... But I'm going to guess at who you're talking about. Is he the guy who's always the Mexican who gets killed by something?
No.
Okay. Because that guy's also in this movie.
No. Yes, it is. This is the redneck who's getting revenge for his brother.
Yes, yes. That guy is also in a lot of things, including, isn't he the guy in Suburban Commando who says he's going to sue Hulk Hogan? Like, it's the 90s. We're going to sue you. Yeah. No, I know who that guy is, too. But the guy who also shows up in this movie is... Nameless Dead Mexican is the only, I don't know the actor's name, but he's always the guy who shows up to die. He gets eaten by one of the graboids in Tremors. He's stomped on by a Tyrannosaurus in The Lost World. Like, he's got like dark curly hair. You'll know him the second you see him, which is kind of how you can describe this entire cast. Even if you don't know the names we're saying, you'll know them as soon as you see them. Even Larry B. Scott, as we mentioned, who, by the way, was the funniest part of this movie, was trying to sell me on Larry B. Scott as a badass.
Oh, and because it's 1987, there's even one brief appearance by Lin Shaye. Again,
that's right. Yes, that is
Lin
right.
Lin Shaye shows up because, of course, she does, because it's 1987.
Because why not? So this movie, Extreme Prejudice, is
actually two movies.
It is two movies going on simultaneously.
It is. Here's what's so weird about this movie, and what's so exciting about this movie is it's one of those movies that once you watch it, you're like, okay, I see why this may not have completely connected. I see why. It's been kind of relegated to the dustbin of history because structurally it's all over the map. It is two different movies that share the same villain that are happening simultaneously, where the casts actually briefly cross paths and then end up in the same ending, but they're two different endings. Like it is such a crazy movie. You have, on one hand, you have a Black Ops military movie of the likes of Basic, which we talked about with our Sam Jackson episode. And then you have this deep fried Southern Texas revenge story that is about, you know, a lawman and a criminal who were best friends as boys, grew up, and then went off in completely opposite paths.
Yeah.
So you have the Justified kind of story. And these two movies keep bumping heads.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting. A couple of the names we didn't mention from this roster of ingredients, produced by Andre Vanya and Mario Casar. So on one end, you have a fucking Rambo movie going on, and on the other side, you have a Peckinpah movie going on.
Oh, yes.
And I'm sorry, like, maybe this is just, like, the lizard part of my man brain speaking, but fucking thank you, universe.
Yeah, and then, like, the Rambo movie gets a Peckinpah ending.
Again, thank you, universe.
Like, it's this movie, it really is one of those movies that you can't just show to anybody, because some folks, like, as far as an action movie goes, there's a lot going on, and they're not going to explain it to you. You're just going to have to kind of pick it up as it goes along, because they're going to throw out little plot points to you in the midst of shootouts and such. And you're going to have to be like, oh, shit, this is what's really going on. And you're going to have to put the pieces together. This is a movie that is not your average dumber than it looks action fare. It is something that is really tightly wound, and really probably, in order to make it a bit more mainstream, needed another 20, 25 minutes of exposition seated in. But what makes this awesome is they're like, fuck it. It's pure. It's got that Milius sense of, you'll figure it out.
Yeah. And so what's going on here is that Nick Nolte is playing Jack Benteen, who's a Texas Ranger, who, as Cargill mentioned, his best friend from childhood is a character called Cash Bailey.
Because of course he is.
I'm sorry. We mentioned this on a mailbag, which you guys can listen to if you're a patron. We mentioned this on a mailbag. I love the character name of Cash Bailey. Kind of wish the character's name was just Powers Booth, because that is equally
Booth
as awesome
is a
character
name. Than Cash Bailey, but Cash Bailey's still kind of an awesome deep-fried Southern gangster name.
And buys his suits at what I assume is the John Travolta Southwest clothing store, because he looks like he's in Saturday Night Fever. He has got a stark white cowboy outfit going on with the hat to match, and he looks... This is the first time I've ever thought this in any movie. Powers Booth is one handsome motherfucker. Like, yeah. He looks really good in this movie. And we mentioned this
but
talking...
But he's clearly not from the Southwest, because no one from the Southwest would actually buy white suits when all they're doing is hanging out in the sweat and dust.
It is functionally inappropriate, that suit. It looks amazing, but yes, is functionally inappropriate.
How many white suits do you imagine they went through so that the people watching the movie didn't think he was just wearing brown suits?
Are you referring to the number of supposedly good guys who die in this movie? How many white suits did they go through? Because that's a good question as well.
Also a good question.
But one of my favorite things about this movie, we talked about, again, on that mailbag episode, about Powers Booth always being the most dangerous guy in the room. As a performer, he was always the guy in the movie that you were afraid of. It just kind of exuded that menace and did it so well. But the thing we didn't really touch upon that I think identifies him so much as an actor is he had this charm. Holy crap, is he charming. Like, in every villain role he ever played, there's at least one moment where you feel yourself kind of liking him. You could see yourself having a drink with him. You could see yourself maybe having several drinks with him. He's just got that... There's something about him, and it's usually... Like, in this movie, it's the way he and Nick Nolte have such a begrudging respect for one another that plays into, when we'll talk about it, the final scene of this movie, which I think is really the crowning glory of Extreme Prejudice. But I loved watching Powers Booth just control the scene in a way that he knew that he was the most dangerous person in the room. He knew he could turn things to his advantage on a dime, and just enjoying being the toughest guy in the room and enjoying it to a point where he could kind of let his guard down a little bit and just have a casual conversation with Nick Nolte.
And, you know, I think this leads to the other problem this movie has connecting with audiences, which is the fact that Powers Booth as the villain is far more charming and interesting than our protagonist is. Because this is a classic example of Nick Nolte kind of grunting and growling his way through.
Fucking hell. Texas Rangers.
And that's just him having sex with Maria Conchita Alonso. Like that's just, like
apparently.
He's like just this kind of misogynistic, angry, constantly reminiscing to his teen years because it was the only time he was fucking happy, miserable Southern Texas Ranger who just really is bitter about a lot of things and never has a moment of levity to him. Even his closest friends and companions can barely cut. They like love the guy, but they can barely seem to stand the guy.
There's a great scene where Rip Torn comes into his office and just says morning. And he goes, what's good about it? And Rip Torn, who is fucking awesome in this movie.
Yes.
Rip Torn just sits down and goes, well, hell son, I just said morning. Didn't say nothing about it being good. I love that moment so much because you do get that sense of like he really is kind of an asshole. And apologies to real life Texas Ranger Joaquin Jackson, who apparently Nick Nolte based this entire performance off of and spent time with and learning the mannerisms and the dress and the day to day activities of being a Texas Ranger. And I will say this for Nolte, it's the most intelligible he is in a film because his graveliness is brought down a little bit by his southern accent affectation that he's putting on, so you can kind of understand him better in this movie than most movies he's in, which was disappointing for me because my favorite Nick Nolte is the fuck. But it is pretty great that the carryover from 48 Hours is he has a beautiful girlfriend who he really should be paying more attention to, but for some reason isn't. It's the exact same thing as is it Annette O'Toole is that who plays his girlfriend in 48 Hours, who's just like gorgeous and way out of his league, and he just like can't be bothered. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me, man? Talk about sitting on a winning lottery ticket, which is how I felt watching this. Is like, how have I not seen Extreme Prejudice, as big as a Walter Hill fan as I am? So that story is going on where, as a Texas Ranger, he feels like he has to bring down Cash Bailey, even though they were childhood friends. And then you've got this other story where the movie opens,
opens with a fucking awesome sequence.
It feels like if there was ever an NES game made out of the A-Team, this is what the beginning of this movie is. It's just a bunch of characters being introduced with literally you cut to their file photo and
you cut to their fake military typewriter. ID.
Fake typewriter, like typing out like killed in action and this date and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's a black bag team. It's a group of guys who the government all has listed as dead, who then go and do undercover missions for the U.S. government. And we're being introduced. And what it is it's a bunch of guys walking into an airport from various places, whether getting off planes or getting out of taxis. And every single one of them is a recognizable 80s character actor of some awesome value, ranging from Clancy Brown all the way down to, you know, guys who are like, oh, that's that dude from that movie. It is, and every time a new character walks in, it's like William Forsythe walks in and starts, misogynistically hitting on every woman that walks by. And as soon as she's out of earshot, he turns to the next nearest woman. And it's like, oh, holy shit, it's William Forsythe. And then boom, you get his ID card and how he died. And then it cuts to another great character actor. And you're just like, what the happy horse shit is going on here? This is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I thought this was a Nick Nolte Powers Booth movie. It's like, no, half of this movie is a Nick Nolte Powers Booth movie. The other half of the movie is Ocean's 11 or the A-Team, and you're not quite sure which until about halfway through.
Yeah.
Like, you're literally sitting there going, wait, I don't know if these guys are the bad guys or the good guys. And the movie's like, we're not telling you. you're gonna have to figure that out for yourself. Like, you have no idea. They're just doing their job, and you have no idea what their ultimate motivations are, and if you should be rooting for them or even like them or not.
You know, and what you want to find out what his movie's about, I just sit and fucking watch it.
Nick Nolte shows up and starts growling at people, and you're like, oh, I'm supposed to like Nolte. Okay, that's our protagonist. But then these guys, they're just this weird X factor that you're just like, I don't know. And And then as that story unfolds, that story actually becomes more interesting than what's going on with Nolte and Powers Booth.
Although to the story A question marks credit, the opening that Nolte has with Rip Torn feels like the final scene of Rolling Thunder. And I really appreciated that about it.
I felt that exact same way.
I was like, he's killing the Acuna boys. That's what's happening right now. I love this. Like, can this be the whole movie? No, because there's so much other awesome stuff going on in this movie. So just wait. You do kind of get whiplash, though, because it goes back and forth really quickly. The benefit that this movie has is that both the A and B story, which are a little incongruous, are amazing in and of themselves. So I'm okay completely switching back and forth before this strange overlap where you're not really sure who's on the up and up. You're not really sure which force is of more ominous threat. You're really not sure what's going on, but you're enjoying because of it, that it's jam-packed, because the bench is so deep with amazing actors, you kind of don't care.
Yeah,
because you're just enjoying the ride that you're on, and it's certainly a ride.
Yeah, and so what you end up finding out, of course, is that this group, this black bag ops group, is there to disrupt the operations of Cash Bailey, and they're trying to disrupt his flow of cash into the United States, which is being kept at this one, most of which is being kept at this one particular bank. And at the same time, Nick Nolte's trying to take down Cash Bailey. And at one point, the paths cross and the Black Ops team decides to enlist Nick Nolte's help in getting something taken care of. And from that point on, they keep crossing paths. And you then find out that not all the members of the Black Ops team are on the up and up, but they're not all military douchebags either. Like, these are most of the team is a group of good men who do what they do because they love their country and they love their fellow countrymen. Like, I love that moment when there's an order later on that's given, like, that says, you know, you got to take Nolte out. You know, if he gets in the way, take him out. He's not to walk away from this. And they're like, he's a good American doing his job. Like, why would we kill him? Like, he's on our side. He's one of us. Like, it's like this very kind of jingoistic, awesome, like, no, I'm not going to kill an American citizen acting on an op with us to protect information in the op. No, fuck that. That's not, this is a bad beat. And that sows the seeds of discord within the Black Ops group that leads to tension for this very kind of wild bunch ending where,
oh yeah,
almost nobody walks away. Like, it's such a Walter Hill ending. It is so fucking great.
And I think you cannot discount all of the influence here from Sam Peckinpah. And something that I actually was learning doing research during this movie is that Walter Hill, very early on in his career, was an assistant director on, you know, just The Getaway. Or no, I'm sorry, on Bullet. Yeah. You know, no big deal. Just fucking Bullet. Are you kidding me? And there is, and he said in interviews that there's a lot of nods to Peckinpah in this movie. And I think, again, once we get to the ending, holy shit.
Nods to Peckinpah.
It is a Peckinpah movie.
Peckinpah, you're screaming at Peckinpah.
The only thing this movie is missing at the end is Warren Oates. If Warren Oates showed up, it would be a Peckinpah movie. Like, you'd have to stamp it a Peckinpah movie.
I wish Warren Oates was in this
movie. I wish Warren Oates was in every movie. Let's not get it twisted.
You know what? I'll bet you Warren Oates is probably his first choice for the Rip Torn role.
Oh, my God. But see, that's the thing is, actually, this is the most fun I've ever had with a Rip Torn role in anything I've seen him in. I fucking love him in this movie.
He's really great in this movie.
He's such a great, like,
I find it hard to think like him better than I do in the Men in Black series, because I think those are like the ultimate Rip Torns. And there's kind of you and I both have a mad love for Beastmaster, and he's kind of just way over the top and crazy in that. But here, I think he's genuinely likable, like playing a Texas Ranger that's this father figure to Nick Nolte. is just more likable than he's ever been.
But the difference is they're not so disparate in ages. So his interactions with Nick Nolte are more like his interactions with Tommy Lee Jones in Men in Black than they are his interactions with Will Smith in Men in Black. There is a sense of equality that they're on the same footing. And you know, they just have so many great little conversations, which I feel like is probably a carryover from the milliest draft of this script. You know, lines like, you know, Nick Nolte asks him if he's upset that they're allowing women to be Texas Ranger, and he's like, no, I ain't got no problem with that as long as she's 6'6" and mean as a snake. And they just got, oh my God. And the,
oh yeah, by the way, this movie's a little misogynistic. Just a little misogynistic.
There is some...
Well, I mean, a little misogynistic. I mean, it's really fucking Milius level misogynistic.
A troubling use of language at times is what I will say, and a troubling worldview to back it up.
And kind of this female character who's being played tug of war with, who can't make up her own mind about anything.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, no, this movie, in terms of its woke rating, is really dead fucking asleep and couldn't be woken up by a train going past it. Like, it is,
yeah, it's true.
It is a little tone deaf when it comes to the feminism.
I feel like 90% of the... of the problem in that regard with this movie would be eliminated if William Forsythe wasn't in it, because half the things that come out of his mouth are just like, dude, that's the F-bomb you can't drop.
Oh yeah, no, well that's the thing, is that's William Forsythe's character in this movie.
No, and like, I get that, but
like, and that's the interesting thing, and this is the Walter Hillness of it. Like, this is very much in fact, that's one of the things I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things I noticed. This was very much like The Warriors in that way, where if you watch The Warriors from just a character perspective, fuck the Warriors. The Warriors are awful fucking people. Like that scene on the train when there's just a couple of kids coming back from prom.
Yeah.
And the Warriors decide to fuck with them just to fuck with them and show them who's boss. You're like, fuck these guys. These are every asshole everyone doesn't want to run into on the fucking train. This is why people fucking hate gangs. You know, the way the Warriors, you know, treat the lady gang when they run into them, or the way they treat the orphans. Like, these guys are fucking douchebags. The way James Remar, like, is hitting on that undercover cop on the park bench. Like, they're awful people. And that's William Forsythe in this. William Forsythe, he drops the N-bomb. He drops the other F-bomb. He fucking, every woman in this movie, he says horribly offensive things to. But then he has his character turn and we see just how good a dude he really is, and how that's all an act to draw attention to him in a way that people want to look away from him so that nobody will remember what he looks like, because nobody wants to interact with this guy. Like, he's that character, and it's such an interesting angle for this particular character. But then, yeah, he's like screaming at his own teammates. It's like, why are they friends? And it's like, well, because he's actually really good at what he does, and the dude's actually legit. But dear God, the language that comes out of Forsythe's mouth.
See, now that you've said that, all I can imagine is David Patrick Kelly with the bottles going, Warriors, you failed the Bechdel test. It's a different movie. It's a very different movie. It's more woke, but it's a different movie.
Speaking of which, just an aside, because of where we are in history right now, have you watched Twin Peaks yet?
No, I haven't.
Having David Patrick Kelly show up just out of the blue, it
nice.
Just makes me, like, he showing up, you know, seeing him in the John Wick movies just briefly is like, oh, it warms my heart. But seeing him actually get a full scene in a, where he's allowed to just be him, he's still fucking got it, and he's great.
Love
so,
it.
So sidebar done, back to Extreme Prejudice.
Stargrove. So, okay. So all the while, these mercenaries appear to be planning a bank robbery. So we're watching, again, what we think are a bunch of bad dudes with, you know, they're rude and they've got bad attitudes.
Bad hombres.
Bad hombres, battle toads. Again, they just strike me as NES characters. So the narcs are getting together, and it looks like they're about to rob the bank. So you think, oh, well, this is really just a group of criminals plucked from, you know, mercenary pools to pull off a robbery, and it's going to come to a head with Nick Nolte, right? Yeah, that's where we're... Oh, no. No, that's not it, because they have a very specific reason for robbing that bank that revolves around the same bad hombre that Nick Nolte is after. So it's like, okay, this appears to be our way in the door, But then hold on, because Michael Ironside is also posing as a DEA agent, inserting himself into the investigation against Cash Bailey along with Nick Nolte. So it's like, these storylines are kind of forming a bottleneck. I'm not really sure how this is going to reconcile itself.
And then the bank robbery goes wrong.
Goes very wrong.
They lose one of their guys, and Nick Nolte ends up capturing two of the other members of the team. And this is where, again, if you are a movie fan...
Which you should be if you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah, this is the what this movie reminds me of here is it reminds me of Hard Times, where you get to the point where you're like, oh, I see where this movie's going. And then the movie gets there halfway through, and then you're like, well, shit, where the fuck is it going now? Like, what is this movie structurally? That the structure is so weird, you're just kind of thrown off balance, and you're like, well, shit, Nick Nolte's got to, I guess the guys, the Black Ops guys now are going to raid the police station? Like, is that what's going on? And it's like, no, no. And you get one of my favorite badass tropes in films, in which Nick Nolte goes home and finds that there's someone in his house. And of course, the person's just sitting in the living room in the dark going, we have to have a talk.
Yeah.
I must expose you to plot elements. And you're like, fuck, this never goes well.
It's that Mad Men moment of shut the door, have a seat.
Yeah, shut the door, have a seat. And so Ironsides lays it out and says, here's what's going on. Here's what I need you to do. And then Nick Nolte essentially becomes kind of a plus one to the team and goes and lets them out of jail. And you have that whole, hurrah, we're all on the same page. Let's go get Cash Bailey moment. It's like, all right, I know what this movie is again. But wait, there's more.
That's what this movie is. It's a late night infomercial, because just when you think it's over, oh, but wait, there's more. We're going to double the deal. We're going to put two movies for the price of one. And you're like, that doesn't sound smart. We're going to do it anyway. Go fuck yourself. Okay.
Because not only do you find out that the Black Ops guys now have orders to kill Nick Nolte once everything goes down, you find out that Michael Ironsides isn't trying to disrupt Cash Bailey's empire. He's trying to remove all evidence that they're involved with Cash Bailey.
Right.
And
as it turns out, and see if I know, it's going to get way out on a limb and suspend your disbelief, Michael Ironside's in this movie, not a good guy.
What?
I know, right?
Ham from V plays a bad guy?
The deuce, you say. The deuce. Did you say Ham from V?
Yeah.
The TV series V?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Not the
dude,
guy from Scanners?
You know what? No. That's the thing, is for people of a certain age, the love of Michael Ironsides began with V, where he plays like the hard-boiled one of the leaders of the human resistance, and then seeing him in movies like Scanners and Extreme Prejudice and Starship Troopers and Total Recall. These are all like, oh, dude, it's Ham. And eventually it's like, oh, it's fucking Michael Ironsides. And you realize that Michael Ironsides just has this incredible genre history. But yeah, for some of us, me in particular, he started as Ham on V.
See, every time you say Ham from V, I just think you can't make up your mind as to which terrible euphemism for vagina you're trying to pick. And I'm like, will you just settle on one and let this podcast go down the drain like it's supposed to? You're making it happen too fast. And I'm like, oh, this TV
slow
series.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the V jokes last now.
Hey-o.
Traveling down the cobblestone.
Speaking of being a radio show, everybody.
Movies.
We are, in fact, a radio show. We've slipped back in time through the time-space continuum.
Feeling boobies.
Flash. Michael Ironside, not the good guy he professes to be. Oh, I love you, Michael.
But what's great is the rest of his team is. And
yeah.
Man, are they pissed about the betrayal. So
oh, they're not
only
happy
do you
about
have
it.
The ultimate final showdown between Cash Bailey and Nick Nolte, you also have a showdown between all of these great fucking B-movie badasses who you love versus Michael Ironside. And so you've got Clancy Brown and William Forsythe versus Michael Ironside. It's like, this is so fucking cool.
It really is. And we're going to talk about where that showdown happens, because it is the centerpiece of the movie. But I want to bring up one thing real quick that I discovered in my research that might lend a little bit of insight to what we were talking about. According to Michael Ironside, in an interview not too many years ago, he said there's 45 minutes that were cut from this movie.
Things that don't surprise me.com.
But 45 minutes? This movie is like an hour 40.
This movie is an hour 40, and this movie has such a big cast of characters and is so tight for what's happening. Like, literally, there is not enough time to fill in everything. There are moments where you are playing catch-up. There's a... During the bank robbery sequence, it is cut so quickly that you are, you know, it's very action movie. It's very 80s action movie. But, like, there's this sequence that seems just kind of weird where the guys are, like, racing really, really quickly and driving recklessly and get caught in the sand.
Yeah, what is, why is that scene? Because you think it's going to lead to somebody's going to be late and that's going to throw everything off.
Which it is.
But that's not really... I don't know. Like, I feel
it
like
it is. They just don't set it up because whatever that was got trimmed out. All the information we're given is this is the timing, radio silence, don't be late. And I feel like there was probably a little more padding there to let the audience in on what the timing was and how that works. And it's just, it's like, nope, here it is. And then they're driving quickly. And at this point, you still don't know if they're the good guys or the bad guys. So it's right. kind of confusing whether you should be rooting for them or not. And then they get caught in the sand. It's like, oh, hey, the plan's going to go off poorly. So Nick Nolte's going to catch him. Yay. But that's, that's not really how it goes down. How it goes down to these guys while they're trying to, what's really happening is while these guys are trying to get to the bank on time, to provide cover for their escape, they don't have enough time to get from where they wreck the truck to distract the cops to the bank in time, because they needed to get enough space between them to so that all the cops head out to one place, they cut the phones so nobody can get the bank report in time and the bank robbery report in time, and so the cops won't be able to make it back in time. They'll make a clean getaway, but that means they've got to be far enough to do it. So they are racing through the outskirts of town so that nobody pulls them over for speeding, and sure right. enough, they're driving through very sandy areas because they're in east or west fucking Texas, and they get stuck in the sand and they can't get out, and because they can't get out, they can't cover the guy they need to cover. When one of their men leaves the bank, he gets shot to death, and that throws everything into disarray.
So here's my question, because a lot was going on in my house while I was watching this, so maybe I'm not remembering correctly. Does the Chubbs storyline tie into either storyline A or B?
Yes. The Chubbs brothers are working with Cash Bailey.
Okay.
And they're part of the ring that he's trying to bust up. And at the same time, while he gets into the shootout, that's what convinces Michael Ironside and the Black Ops crew that this cop is a legit cop and he's not to be trifled with. Like, this guy that single-handedly took out half a dozen other guys in a shootout and did it without breaking a sweat. And
there's
so,
a great moment in the first of the four amazing shootouts in this movie. Can we just talk about how great Walter Hill is at filming shootouts? Like, something that he and Peckinpah share.
How great Walter Hill is, period.
Yeah, but I mean, something that he and Sam Peckinpah share specifically is they both are masters of filming shootouts. I mean, the setting of this movie, the dustiness of this movie, the themes of this movie, yeah, of course it's going to be considered a Western, but it's the fucking framework and the construction of the shootouts that really make this a great Western.
Which also is kind of heartbreaking in the fact that this movie's so hard to get a hold of right now. The only way to get it digitally is in an SD full frame version that you have to buy for like $6. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't, there is no current restoration right now that is floating around. There's no readily available clean HD version that you can watch. It is, I assume there must be a Blu-ray or a DVD, a good cleaned up DVD out there somewhere, hopefully. But man, it's kind of heartbreaking to see this great cinematography, like, full frame. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I bought it from like the Xbox store, and it looked like a VHS rip. I was kind of pissed off.
That's what it was. Like, it's the VHS SD copy. Like, that's very much what this was.
It was not great. But something else I found interesting is that they started working on this movie in 1976, and then when Milius wrote it, and he was supposed to direct it, but then instead he went off and made, was it Big Wednesday, I believe, was the movie that he went off and made instead. And I'm thinking now, like, if they had made this movie in 1976, you better fucking believe one of the two principal roles would have gone to Warren Oates. And I feel like it would have been the Cash Bailey role that would have gone to Warren Oates.
Let's Dreamcast this.
Let's do Dreamcast this. Let's Sega Dreamcast this shit, which means our casting that we're going to do will be every bit as important and long-lasting as a Sega Dreamcast.
Steve McQueen.
Ooh, I love it already.
Warren Oates.
Yes. Yes.
And leading the team, Yul Brynner.
See, I was going to say Lee Marvin. So
Lee Marvin would be awesome, but Lee Marvin, I think at this point, was just a hair too old to be the leader of...
To be the Michael Ironside's character?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I think at 76,
I mean,
I would have loved...
You're speaking my language there.
Yeah. I feel like we're just casting the Dirty Dozen again. we're blending up the Dirty Dozen with the Magnificent Seven
yeah. instead of Dirty Dozen.
Which I can't do that movie math.
This is. Yeah. I mean, Jesus Christ, this particular cast of people are all the guys in all of the best genre films of the 80s. They're just, if you delete Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Christopher Lambert from that list, this is everybody from all of their movies. Like, I mean, that's what this pretty much is. Like, yeah. it's all of those, and that's fucking great. Like, it's kind of crazy that Nick Nolte is the anchor of this movie, and really, Nick Nolte does a fine job.
Like, he really does, and he put himself into this role. Like, he lost 50 pounds for it. We talked about the training he went through. Like
he was, this was when he was, when he opened a movie. The thing mm-hmm. is that through the history of film, all of the character actors of this movie subsequently are so much cooler than Nolte.
Right. Like, he is definitely.
This cast is just so giddy. It's so junky a cast.
Like, he's super square in this movie. Like,
oh, yeah.
Everybody else is so cool and at times really unhinged and perfect. And he is, you know, by design, very square.
But he's got that old Western sheriff kind of thing where he does three or four times during this movie, he has a scene where he's just like, this is a highly dangerous situation. You stay here. I'm going to walk in.
Yeah. I will give you three guesses, Cargill. If you were to guess what classic Western star Walter Hill made Nick Nolte watch a bunch of his films before filming this movie.
That's got to be John Wayne.
Try again, but you're very close. Think a little further back than John Wayne.
Further back?
A little further back than John Wayne. Like 50s era Westerns. Strong, silent type, always does the right thing, never...
You mean further forward than...
No. I'm talking further back because...
You're talking Roy Rogers?
No, I'm talking about Gary Cooper.
Oh, Gary Cooper. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Because apparently that's something that Walter Hill made Nick Nolte do, was watch a bunch of Gary Cooper movies before. And you totally get that because yeah. High Noon, which is, by the way, an amazing movie and still holds up, Gary Cooper is the square center of that movie. Oh, he is the town square, literally.
Take a drink. One of these days, we need to do High Noon versus Outland.
Oh, absolutely.
We got to do an
episode. That's the only way to do both of those movies for this show is to put them right face to face.
So take two drinks.
Take two drinks. Take all the drinks.
Take all the drinks.
Hey, if you get the end of this movie, you're going to be taking a lot of fucking drinks. Don't you worry about it. Because, okay, so... Before I get there, because I really want to get there, the shootout at Chubbs' place, the first big shootout of the movie, where Rip Torn's character unfortunately dies, and it's kind of heartbreaking, is an amazing fucking, like, I remember my fiance came in, she's like, this movie's really violent. And I'm like, yep, it's a Walter Hill movie.
Yeah, it is.
There's a great moment where he's being stalked around his truck, and he drops down and just blows this guy's foot completely apart. Like, I've seen this gimmick in movies before where you shoot out the guy's foot when he's trying to come around the other side of the car, but this guy's foot explodes like a quinceañera pinata. Like,
and
it is.
He starts screaming like a stuck pig.
Oh my God, it's amazing. And then, yeah, so that is one of four amazing shootouts in this movie, I believe I counted. So let's talk about the ending of this movie.
Yes.
Let's talk about Powers Booth fucking owning this movie. And we get to the end of the film, and it has become...
Because no matter what happens, here's what's interesting about this dynamic and what we're walking into, is these characters are given a handful of scenes together on screen. And Powers Booth and Nick Nolte, every time they get together, all they do is reminisce about old times. And it is very much two guys who ended up, like, at one point they talk about, like, having one girl and essentially pulling a three-way with her, you know, taking turns with her behind a farmhouse. Like,
yeah.
They talk about the good old days. They, again, misogynistic, just a hair.
Which is a really weird foreshadowing for the fact that there's a love triangle between Maria Conchita Alonso, Nick Nolte, and Powers Booth. So it's like, by telling that story, is it like Chekhov's three-way, where it's like by telling that story at the beginning of the movie, you think that's what's going to happen at the end of the movie with those three?
It's no, that is not.
It's creepy. It's like, if you're going to tell that story and then have a love triangle, I have to draw conclusions that I don't want to draw.
Yeah, but so they're reminiscing about what it was like to, you know, to grow up together and be buddies. There's one time where Nick Nolte is talking to Rip Torn about going and smoking some dirt weed, some dirt farm weed with Powers Booth all the time. And he's like, "What? I never caught you?" He's like, "Of course you didn't catch us, old man." And, you know, he really, they both fondly, they want to return to this innocence of their high school lives, and they want the respect of their best friend, but they're on different sides of the law.
Yeah.
You got one guy who is very much a Texas Ranger and very much believes in the law. And you got another guy who, is dealing with his own law and his own way of the world, and lives in this wonderful villa in a small town up in the mountains where he's got his own army and he's got everything he wants, except the girl who happens to be living with Nick Nolte, who kind of seems like he doesn't give a fuck. Like, he does, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, he's that very old school kind of baby boomer / looking back at the 50s, I don't show my emotions kind
like
of guy.
Like Gary Cooper!
Yes, like Gary Cooper. And so she is conflicted because she loves him, but she's not getting love back from him. And here's this guy who she also has feelings for that seems to want her more than anything. And so she's very conflicted and caught in this tug of war, and finally decides to run off with Cash Bailey and go live in the mountains in his place. And apparently it doesn't work out. Like, yeah. We get one line of dialogue, like, "We haven't gotten along at all. Like, what the fuck? You seem so charming, Powers yeah. Booth. Like, what did you do wrong? Were you nice to her? Like, what is, like, apparently..."
I love that. "Were you nice to her? Is that what you did wrong, Powers
like,
Booth?"
Well, I mean, look, she's stuck with Nick Nolte that whole... He, like, crawls into bed. "I don't want to talk about it. I love you." Like, you know, he... "Oh, good. You came to listen to me sing and didn't say anything nice about my singing, but you're drinking, so..."
Which,
clearly...
I love Maria Conchita Alonso, but there might be a reason he didn't say anything nice about her singing.
She is doing a thankless job in this movie because she is the heart and soul of this movie. Like, she, between her and Rip Torn, they're the only kind characters in this movie. It's not until the third act that we finally get some kindness out of this great character actor cast, because we don't know if we're supposed to like them or not. And she is playing a Milius written character. Like, that's the only way you can really, like, this is one of those really bad women roles in a movie that could give a shit about women, but acknowledges that we need to have some softness in this movie so that it's just not all machismo pissing contest, that we need to see the softer side of these characters. And that's the heavy lifting that Alonso and Rip Torn are doing in this movie. So she's written terribly, but as a performance, she's doing great because everything else is coming out of her performance. And there is a lot of humanity in that character, and it's all her and it's not on the page. And you can tell that throughout the entire thing. Like, she is really giving it her all and hasn't been given much to work with in terms of that, which is, it's, You know, this is just that it's one of the relic aspects of history. This was how women were treated in screenwriting for a period of time. And the 80s was one of those really bad times about it. So it is one of those elements to the script that doesn't work, but she makes work, and that Walter Hill makes work with her. And so ultimately you end up feeling for her, but here she is in this compound and Nick Nolte is coming to get her, and Nick Nolte is coming to kill Cash Bailey. Those are the two things he is there to do, and he's not leaving until both of them are done. And so you end up with him once again walking into a situation where it's so crazy that he's walking into it that nobody bothers to shoot him, because it's like, look at this motherfucker. And he goes and he sits down and has a drink with Cash Bailey and Maria Conchita Alonso, and they're going to talk it out. But while they're talking it out, you've got the military men moving in to secure and supposedly destroy evidence that the United States is involved with this guy at all. But really, it's there to steal the evidence that Michael Ironsides is deliberately doing shit on the sly.
And this amounts to what is essentially the longest, most drawn out showdown in the street of any Western you've ever seen. Because they play up so well this relationship between Powers Booth and Nick Nolte, where, yeah, they know one of them's going to die and they are both prepared to kill each other, but they're so cordial. Like, Powers Booth, and again, this is what I was talking about with his charm. Like, he's so likable. He's like, let's have a drink, let's do this, and, you know, I always keep my promises. And Nick Nolte's like, yeah, the problem is getting one out of you. And, like, so much of this dialogue, which is just so rich and so real, and it just, you believe the fact that they are just literally drinking with each other. And there's a great moment where Nick Nolte gets up to get a drink. He's like, where are you going? This is my town. You know, we'll have somebody bring it to you. He's like, I like to get myself. Like, just all these little bitty character moments that build up to this duel.
Speaking of which, you know what we have not talked about?
What have we not talked about?
The scorpion scene.
Oh my
Powers
God.
Powers Booth and the scorpion.
By the fucking way, I have lived in Texas for 9 years and I have never had a scorpion in my house, and that fucking changed over the weekend that I watched this movie.
Of course it did. Yeah, no, it's like sometimes
in the bathroom, fucking asshole.
Sometimes you get, my first scorpion in the house experience was I woke up in the middle of the night to a tickle on my hand.
What now?
And I had a scorpion, my first scorpion experience, I had a scorpion crawling on my hand.
Burn it all down, starting with your hand.
And it tickles, and I'm like, what the? And then I realize it's something skittering across my hand, and I just start winging my hand, and it flies, and I hear a thump across the wall, and I turn on the light, and there's this big, hairy, black scorpion crawling across the floor. I'm like, burn the whole place.
Burn it down. Nuke it from space, the only way to be sure. Only way to be sure. Why would a loving God create these nasty little spider dragons? I don't understand it. I hate them. But I have to give props to my fiance, who is scared of anything that looks like a bug, but because I wasn't home, killed it herself because she didn't want to scare our stepson, and then promptly put it under a cup and a book just in case she hadn't actually killed it so that I could deal with it when I got home.
But Powers Booth, on the other hand.
Powers Booth, I guess I'll go ahead and tease this now. We accidentally, Cargill and I, created the greatest 1987 double feature of all time.
Oh, what 87 double feature, but we watched three movies.
Yes.
And I watched them all back to back to back.
Me too. But the double feature I'm talking about is we're dubbing it Extreme Predator. And there are so many fucking parallels between those two movies that I did not think was going to happen. Including a fucking scorpion scene. But yeah, Powers Booth just like toying with that scorpion before he killed it.
He picks up a scorpion off the ground, is just playing with a scorpion in real fucking time.
Yeah. My fiance came in the room during that scene. It was just after the scorpion incident in our apartment. And I was just like, look at me. Don't look at the TV. Look at me. Because it was just like, there's a big fuck off scorpion on the screen. And Powers Booth is just handling it, which, by the way, apparently did in one take. And
whoa. Yeah, no, there's no cut there.
No, thank you.
That's the thing is, this is power. Like, this is how badass Powers Booth is. Like, this is, and this is the first moment we meet Cash Bailey like this. And it is just, it is fucking fantastic, man. Like, it's when you watch, you're like, all right, this is a bad hombre.
And this final shootout in what is essentially Cash Bailey's town/compound is a thing of carnal beauty. Like, it is just fucking, It's beautiful the way that it's shot. All the various agendas that are just exploding at the same time. You know, guys turning on each other and like armies showing up to do Cash Bailey's dirty work. And then the actual showdown between the two of them, where Nick Nolte gives him every opportunity after the first shot, just be like, just put it down. Doesn't have to be this way. Just put it down. Don't make me kill you. And of course, Powers Booth is just like, do you know me at all? Of course, I'm not going to let that happen. And the chaos, the perfectly executed, exquisitely shot chaos of this final showdown, I loved it so much. I was like, this is everything about Walter Hill that I love right here in this scene. You have amazing characters. You have these brutal conflicts, these really classic themes, and an embrace of violence as an art form that few other directors, I really think, grasp.
And then you get this great final moment after Cash Bailey is dead. He's on the ground. And Nick Nolte goes to leave with Maria Conchita Alonso, and everyone else is dead. And there's all the Cash Bailey's men are there, and they're like, we're not letting you go. And he goes, I think you will. And essentially, he's like, all right, I'll let you go. We'll get you back across the border. But then maybe someday you do me a favor. And he's like, nope, not going to do it. Like
and you're like, what the fuck, Nolte?
With all these guns trained on him, he will not turn. He believes in law and order. Like, it is that Gary Cooperness coming out. And he's like, I already did you a favor. You get to wear the white suit now. And the way his second in command reaches down and takes the hat and kicks his boot.
Yeah.
And Powers Booth is now just a prop lying in the street. And they realize, oh, shit, we don't have to take orders from that guy anymore. All right, cool.
Well, and you see it, too. You see it dawn on that guy.
Yeah.
When he says, you get to wear the white suit now, and he looks over at Powers Booth, and he just kind of looks back at Nick Nolte, and you see that registering for the first time. Oh, shit, I get to be the leader of this gang now. And I love that they make a specific statement about working for themselves, because one of the interesting things about the character of Cash Bailey is that he was a police informant. He's an American who was a police informant and then crossed the border and basically became king of the drug trade. But he's not a native Mexican. So there's this interesting moment where his henchmen are like, well, we work for ourselves now. We're going to make money for ourselves, and we're not going to take orders from... And you get... It's this weird, like, again, jingoism. This weird rah-rah jingoism moment where it's like, we work for ourselves now. And it's like, I'm happy for you, question mark, that you're now independent in the drug trade. You know what? You do you, I guess. But yeah, that entire finale.
Yeah, if there's
is
anything
so
that's
epic.
Gone well over the last 30 years, it's the Mexican drug trade.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It's
I mean,
such a happy place. You know, they use chainsaws to cut down trees all the time because there's so little else to do with their chainsaws. And you know
what? Drug cartels, less bankruptcies than Trump. That's all I'm going to say. They're making it work when they have to make it work.
I got a feeling the next time we run into each other, we're going to have a killing.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. I feel like the only thing that can possibly be the junk food pairing of this movie is tequila shots, because you spend a good 10 minutes in the final act of this movie just doing tequila shots with Powers Booth. And considering the entire inspiration of us talking about this movie was the passing of Powers Booth, I feel like he would appreciate all of us sitting around in a dingy bar south of the border and just putting away tequila shot after tequila shot, reminiscing about the old days. And I don't remember the brand, but there is a brand of tequila that literally has a dead scorpion in it. And I feel like, you know, grab yourself some of that, kick a few back, reminisce about the old days. Try not to kill each other, but if that happens again, you do you.
I had this very kind of specific feeling about this film in terms of the junk food pairing. I feel that this movie needs a hunger buster with large fries.
What the fuck is a hunger buster? Why does that sound familiar?
Because the hunger buster is the big hamburger from Dairy Queen.
Oh,
and
there it is.
You've ever been at, like, this movie is so small town Texas. Like, this movie is small town Texas as fuck. And if you've ever been in small town Texas and you've been hungry and you want junk food, there are only two places to go. One is going to be whatever local diner dive is there in town that is owned by the same old family that's had it for
like the chicken place in this movie that they blow up with a rabbit.
Yes.
Like it's a fucking Monty Python sketch.
Yeah. And
What?
And the other thing is you can go to Dairy Queen, as the old saying goes. You didn't get to be on the map in Texas unless you had a Dairy Queen in it. And so every small fucking town has a Dairy Queen. So I feel that as junky as this food is, with so many fucking junk food favorites, I feel that this is about as junky as it gets. And you need to eat it with a nice jalapeno covered with bacon Hunger Buster with large fries and a big dollop of ketchup. Like this is a big, junky, delicious treat.
That was something I wrestled with when I first moved to Texas, is the commercials for Dairy Queen used to say, DQ, that's what I like about Texas, which would enrage me because I'm like, why do you think you have ownership of this? Like, that's what I like about Texas infers that only Texas has Dairy Queen. And I can assure you that is not the case. It made no sense to me at all. But like you said, there were small towns that weren't on the map until they had themselves a Dairy Queen.
Yeah.
Where you could get a Hunger Buster, gorge out on that, feel totally defeated, and then go have yourselves a few tequila shots on the way home. That sounds like a good Friday. I'm on board with that. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us for Extreme Prejudice.
Extreme!
And join us next week for the second half of this double feature of Extreme Predator, which is...
Spoiler warning.
Spoiler warning. It's fucking Predator, guys. It's fucking Predator.
87, bitches.
87. How are we not going to talk about Predator? I'm just happy that we were able to fit in a Walter Hill film and pay tribute to Powers Booth, who is a fucking legend, and I'm so happy that he still lives on in movies that I get to discover, like Extreme Prejudice. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/massworm, MASSAWYRM, or Facebook, facebook.com/massworm. Also, you can find me on Random Movie Night, a new podcast on Up Rocks, where we talk about Cannonball Run 2, and that was a lot of fun, so check that out.
Wait a minute, is Roger Moore in Cannonball Run 2 as well as Cannonball Run 1?
Yes.
Wait. Wait for it, guys.
No, I don't think Roger Moore is in the second one.
Okay.
I want to say that he's not in the second one. I just rewatched this, and then Roger Moore died, and then I rewatched all the scenes with him in Cannonball Run, and I want to say he's not.
It doesn't appear that he is in the second one, but... Yeah, that was a blow. He's the first of the Bond actors to go, and that was rough.
Yeah.
So RIP Powers Booth and RIP to Roger Moore. Sir Roger Moore, excuse me. You can find me on the interwebs at Bryguy Salisbury on Twitter. You can also find this show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you want older episodes than iTunes has available, you can go to Libsyn, LIBSYN.com. You can find direct download links to every single one of our episodes. I actually have been posting over the last week some random throwback episodes, including our very first one, so I know it's all there.
So we now have the answer. You can, on Libsyn, get all of them.
All of our episodes.
Those of you who are like, man, I've listened to all 100 of these. It's like, no, there's at least a year and a half of stuff that you may have missed.
Yeah, we are well into our third year of doing this, so there's quite a catalog of episodes if you're interested. And if you really like those episodes and you decide, how can I support this show, you can go to patreon.com, become a patron. We will throw you some bonus episodes, mailbags, a la modes, summer of 77, so much cool stuff we do for patrons, and that is not stopping anytime soon. So definitely go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
We've got a big one. You thought Star Wars was big. You thought Sorcerer was big. Summer 77. We've got Smokey and the Bandit, the epic fucking exploitation film.
Hell
that,
yeah.
One of Hal Needham's biggest successes.
So true. And I'm so excited to talk about that. So sign up now. We're going to end this episode reminding you to be very, very particular about who you drink with.